I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There can be a bit of a conversation online. Oh my God, everything's ADHD. Hopefully conversations like this, it's going to kind of feed through.
I want to talk about general kind of living with ADHD. 5% of children and 3% of adults. Like, that's a lot of people. What would you say the biggest ways that affects your kind of day-to-day life?
The struggle is really real. I will almost reach kind of panic attack level.
Yeah.
Part of ADHD, there's an executive function problem, but there's ways to really reinvigorate jobs and make them exciting. Like, for anyone that is in that place really struggling, it's never as bad as you seem, but it's absolutely part of the experience. We don't hear that narrative very often. What you've said is absolutely so beautiful. We should celebrate. It's something that we are a bit embarrassed to talk about.
What is up, guys, and welcome back to Working Hard, Hardly Working. Today's episode is a special one that I've wanted to do for a while now. I obviously talk about productivity tips a lot, and we talk about work and how we can get our shit together and everything on this podcast a lot and in general across my socials. And one of the things that I always try to caveat is the difference in experience between productivity tips you might see online and general kind of what might work best for people in terms of, you know, what makes them more productive, what makes them more effective in their work, what makes progression easier, all of these things. But actually the difference between what that will be like between someone who has some sort of neurodivergence and someone who doesn't, someone neurotypical. And so I really wanted to do this episode to highlight the experience of ADHD, talk about living, learning, being productive, loving, dating, all of those things with ADHD from the standpoint of an adult's diagnosis, just because I know that, I mean, I assume that everyone that listens to this podcast is an adult. I don't know if I've hit up with the 16-year-olds yet, but hopefully they think I'm cool. But I hope you really enjoy this episode. I absolutely loved recording it. It's a very open heart-to-heart about the experience of living with ADHD and kind of attempting to take away a lot of the taboos around it and surrounding not just like productivity, but things like financial budgeting, things like getting into debt, things like alcohol addiction, a number of these different things. So we hit on a lot of these topics in this episode. If you are triggered by any of them, please read the description first to be able to see if the topics might be too triggering for you. But I personally found this a really, really interesting and heartwarming episode, and I hope that especially if you have a neurodivergence or have an ADHD diagnosis, you'll be able to find this really helpful. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please rate the podcast, share it with your friends, and let me know how you found it. And as always, have a wonderful day. Thanks so much for joining me, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
First things first, it would be great if you guys could introduce yourself in terms of what you do and kind of a little bit of backstory in terms of how you got to where you are now.
My name's Rox. I am a singer-songwriter, have been for 15 years, about 13 years. Lots of failing, let's put it that way. In the last couple of years, things have started to go great. As part of that journey was finding out that I also have ADHD. I found out when I was 36, and it was a bit of a bombshell moment. And alongside Rich, as a bit of a joke, we started this social media channel called ADHD Love. And over the last year, it just kind of took off and went quite viral. And we've got this wonderful community of people online really resonating with these weird, wonky things that I do in my life. And yeah, I'll let you tell the story of how that started because I'm a bit embarrassed.
Yeah.
Well, oh, now I'm interested.
My background is less creative. So I've worked for a bank for 20 years. So never really in the creative space or content. I didn't even have, I think I had Instagram, one Instagram account with like one post on it when we
you
met.
You had six posts. Right. And they were like really like dad posts.
Right, yeah.
So I was like really into the social media world through music. to have a sort of music project. And I remember talking to you about TikTok and what's that? That's for kids. It's so funny to now see him every day checking the data, logging on, editing. It's amazing what a couple of years can do.
And then, yeah, so we the start of our social media account, it's written in the book, actually, the first chapter is she, like, this is quite graphic for
Hi, lovely to meet you. Please give me all of your graphic secrets.
You know, one of the things about having an ADHD female partner is that they don't always remember when their periods are due.
Before the Flow app. Now I'm on the Flow app.
Okay.
Everything's fine. Well,
whilst you're using the Flow app.
Yeah.
And one night she said, I'm on my period. And I said, have you got a tampon in? Because she hasn't always got the right products available. And she said, yeah, I've got a tampon in. And a bit of a running joke, like sometimes in the past, hasn't used Tampax certified products. They've been kind of DIY, which we've referred to as trampon. And so I asked her whether it was a real one. She said, yes. She said, yeah, that would be a funny social media video. And I went, yeah, let's give it a go. Let's start it tomorrow. No chance. So we were up at 1 o'clock in the morning creating that. And that was our first video. And that was the birth of ADHD Love. It seems like years ago now, but it was only about a year and a half, I think.
Yeah.
Amazing. What a starting story. I feel like when you must have like sat and talked to a publisher about that, they must have been like, oh yeah. You know, when they're sitting like there and they're like, well, it's not glass offices and they're like, that's really nice.
It's not the origin story you expect.
Yeah,
but
sure.
I think it's absolutely perfect for my personality.
Yeah.
No, it
does say a lot, actually. So like setting the scene very well. Tell me about what's happened since then.
It just went mad, didn't it? Like, I think our second video went viral. Mm-hmm. I suppose that the big thing was not only the followers coming in, but actually how much that they were connecting with the content. A lot of people kind of felt understood. I think that's probably the theme around, oh my God, this is me.
That's the comment that we see all the time. Oh my God, that's my brain.
Yeah.
And it's really funny because it's often our whole take on it was kind of sharing the things I think about me, like really odd and weird.
Yeah.
And that other people wouldn't relate to. For example, this pair of socks I'm wearing, I've bought 20 pairs of this sock so that I can just wear them every day because I love them, because they bring a lot of dopamine, and so I don't have to worry about matching them. And we put that on the internet the other day, and then there's thousands of people saying, I've done that too. Like, where are these
people? You forgot to mention you threw away all of your other socks.
I threw away all the other socks because about these that obsession when you want to do something.
Yeah.
You go all in. And then, yeah, as the kind of community started growing, and it really wasn't meant to happen. Mm. As he said, he was working in the bank and I was doing my artist career. And as we started to hear people kind of say, it was really helping, especially with shame removal.
Mm. And talking about taboos as well, like that's
like the tampon story.
Yeah, like the tampon story in terms of like that is it's a taboo within a taboo, because you're speaking about like your something that's already a taboo, like talking about something personal and like talking about, you know, periods and all of that. Like there's already, people feel a bit like, oh, they can only talk about it in certain ways and only in certain environments. And then you add on to that, like the fact that you're talking about your personal response with it, when you know that there are some people who might not understand at all and might, you know, say whatever they want to say, whatever people say on the internet. And actually being able to kind of normalize both of those things and just be open about it, I can imagine creates a really safe space for some people who have felt like, probably like you, have felt like no one else would do that. And 100%. Actually, you're one of many. I mean, I've got my stats here.
Ooh, thank you very much.
Lovely.
But like the fact that it is the most common behavioral, well, it says disorder, we've discussed briefly before the episode how it's referred to as a disorder, but it feels much nicer to be calling it a neurodivergence, the most common one in the UK. That's, you know, that's very, very significant when you look at also other common neurodivergence like dyslexia, like a lot of these kind of other things. For 5% of children and 3% of adults, like there are going to be lots of people. That's a lot of people. I think that's like 1.5 million people. So that's a lot, like that's a lot of people to be sitting there with their DIY tampons. And that's only in the UK. So to be able to create that safe space is like, I can understand, would be hugely important and hugely, like, it's you know, we like to call these things a niche. That's a lot of niche. And 1.5 million people is a whole lot of people.
It's actually amazing kind of hearing you say those stats, because the content we create is so much about just the reality of, of my real life with it. And we don't tend to read much of the stats, do we?
No.
So hearing that back, it's really quite eye-opening, because at the moment, sometimes there can be a bit of a conversation online, which is a bit of an eye roll. Oh my God, everything's ADHD.
Sure.
More people with ADHD. And actually hearing you say that,
That's just received diagnoses as well. Like, that's medical data. Yeah. So if you're looking at like the issues there are with, I believe like the NHS diagnosis time is a good few years, or even not diagnosis time, even to get the testing is a good few years. And if you go private, it's £700 to £1,000, which if you're, you know, who not a lot of people that. Are not able many, to kind of set aside that much money to be able to find out something that ultimately we also don't have a lot of cures for. So you're likely to be able to, if you're making it that difficult to diagnose, then you've got to understand the presence of self-diagnosis as well in order to be able to like find coping strategies that work for you.
100%. I think that's such an important thing to talk about. And that can come with a lot of shame and kind of semi-political opinions as well on either side. But whether or not you have the official diagnosis, the struggle is really real. If you're struggling to not get overwhelmed or stay on top of financial organisation, or for me, it was at my lowest moments, not opening letters and then ending up with CCJs, having all these weird and wonderful business ideas and then constantly failing with them, overspending on shopping. And the only answer I had was, oh, well, I'm terrible. I'm awful. Something's wrong with me. So if there's people out there who are really resonating with the content, with the research that they might be doing, that's absolutely okay.
Yeah.
And in fact, what we want to see is lower times for people to get diagnosis, not shutting people off from resources that might actually help them feel a bit less ashamed.
I really love that, and I think that's very important. I'd like to talk about your story of diagnosis and how it came about and any earlier signs you felt you kind of had of ADHD. Could you tell a little bit of background about that, kind of set the scene for us?
Absolutely. So mine was really about clearing through a lot of mess that was there until I could see the ADHD signs. So just to set a bit of the story, I was living a pretty difficult life a few years ago, and I had an alcohol and drug addiction, a lot of relationship problems and struggles, chronically low self-esteem, was self-harming up until my early 30s. It's just very dark, a lot of problems. The first thing that I did to really start to change the direction of my life was get sober in 2018. And the removal of alcohol really allowed me to face up to a lot of the problems that I was going through. Of course, alcohol was also the coping mechanism. So when that was taken away, all of the anxiety, all of the issues were suddenly very much at the forefront of my life.
Yeah.
And that led me to go and get some rather incredible therapy in 2020. Throughout that therapeutic process, I was dealing with anxiety and depression, self-esteem issues, really going back to childhood, as often you do in therapy, to go through some difficult things I'd gone through as a kid. And over this kind of year of therapy, I really just started to blossom and get better. It was incredible. And towards the end of my time, when I was really doing okay, was when I said, look, doc, things are going pretty well, but there's a few things I'd like to raise. This week, I've got on the tube the wrong way 5 times. I've lost 3 pairs of iPhone headphones, because suddenly with everything else cleared, I could see this thing, whereas it had been buried in just an entire life of chaos. When I was actually okay and had some support in other areas, there were these glaring things.
Yeah.
And that was the first time she said, wow, that really sounds like it could be ADHD. And funnily enough, my first real knowledge of it was actually through TikTok. It's probably why we ended up going and making TikToks, because I went and searched it and became obsessed with it on TikTok and watching TikTokers. And I don't know, do you remember?
I do, yeah. You come to me and was like, this is me. And it was, I think it was a creator called Connor DeWolf. And you just burst into tears, didn't you, with how much you resonated with his content. And I think it was through then we were fortunate enough through me and the bank that Rox was able to get done privately, mm-hmm. Which is obviously a privilege that many people don't have with long waiting lists and stuff like that. But actually looking at it, Rox doesn't use it as an excuse or anything, but it just helps her make sense of her life, because there was a lot of real negative sort of self-narrative towards herself. And I think that really changed with the diagnosis. And then we started really simply, like, I taught you how to make a bed, like, and simple stuff like that. And damage limitation when it comes to 13 wallets is fine, but let's make sure there's not 13 lots of driving licenses when that goes. So just it's a bit of limitation.
Yeah.
But yeah. And then I suppose you just started getting better and better, didn't you?
Yeah, that was the first moment in my life when there was a language that didn't involve there's something wrong with me, and the chaos in my own head started to make a bit more sense. And I think that's why that language can be so important, when you can suddenly start to understand maybe you're a person that needs a bit more support in order to have a happy life.
Yeah, and I think that, like, our understanding generally is, like, there's a kind of norm within what might be, like, an upper bound or a lower bound about general things. It might be organisation, it might be performance, it might be, like, literally everything. I feel like there's a kind of upper and lower bound of what you kind of expect within something. And what I guess a neurodivergence diagnosis allows you to do is see where you might be outside of that in order to be able to like cope with that and make sense of it, rather than I think there's this really negative connotation of, like, saying that a diagnosis is going to give someone an excuse for what someone might be saying is, you know, oh, just, you know, you should know how to do this, or you should whatever it might be. Surely that's unhelpful to everyone, because for, like, as in, like, we're not back in the 19 whatever, like, we're not using like kind of essentially being like, how dare you need to act like this. Instead, anything that makes everyone perform better and act better and feel better surely is a good thing, even if it might not be for you. So for you, sure it might be that you don't need any help on organization, and actually if someone were to give you more help you'd think you were being patronized. But actually, if that's not your strong suit, in the same way as you might not have a talent in, I don't know, like music or art or whatever, we all have things we're good at and things we're not good at. It's just those, like, core parts of life that we see as, like, organization and productivity and those various different things that I can imagine is, like, some people look at that in quite a derogatory sense, and they're like, you know, able to see it as an excuse or whatever it might be, where actually surely anything that helps you to perform better and make sense of something is better to be putting, like, to help people.
Definitely. But I think when you were first diagnosed, there were occasions, because you're human as well, right? And humans definitely aren't perfect. And there were probably some occasions where you were like, I've got ADHD, I can't make the bed, and I'm definitely going to be late to everything all the time, so I don't even need to try. That sort of, obviously not all the time, but, and you know, with all of us can be lazy, like, that's whether you've got ADHD or not. And Rox definitely can be lazy, as can I.
Absolutely.
But there's a very big difference between looking at a room, a messy room, and going, I'm overwhelmed, I don't know where to start with this, versus, you know, sitting on the bed, I suppose, and saying, I can't.
Yeah, what you've said is absolutely so beautiful, which is, if something helps somebody to be more productive, to achieve more, perhaps even more importantly, to be happy in their personal life.
Yeah, sure.
Then that's absolutely something that we should celebrate. Definitely online, one of our main, we don't get many actually, to be honest, but one of the main hate comments is, this is just laziness, and you're glorifying not trying or not being very good or not taking accountability. And as you said, I never want to be the person that says, no, I could never be lazy. Absolutely I can, and as any human can. So it's really about understanding it's nuanced, and it's all messy because it's all human. But what you said, I think, really sums it up. There's a really big difference between someone saying, and I can talk about me personally, if I'm looking at a really messy room, I'm not even going to try because I have ADHD, so I'm going to leave all of that to you, and actually, I need this to be perfect and I have no idea where to start. Yeah, yeah. And I'm going to end up spending 6 hours and then overwhelming myself and not doing anything. Could you maybe help talk me through it or sit with me as I do it? And actually, I'm way better at a lot of things in all areas of life because of acceptance and understanding.
Yeah.
So it goes a long way.
No, I can completely understand that. And I think that you're looking from an outside perspective at something that's helping someone else and determining it to be wrong. Like that to me seems like misplaced, like just scroll past. Say if someone agreed that it was kind of like glorifying being lazy in that specific video, or whatever it might be. It also like doesn't have that much of an effect on that person's life. Like they're not in your life. So you could probably just scroll past.
It's fascinating as well what people expect people to be able to do, whether it's cleanliness or tidiness or being on time. Yeah, you know, Rock struggles with those things, but she can go and write platinum selling songs. She came up with a creative idea for our book that we like, and it's just, it baffles me sometimes as to what just society expects everyone to be really good at all the time. Mm.
Yeah, for sure. I want to talk about general kind of living with ADHD first of all. What would you say the biggest ways it affects your kind of day-to-day life would be?
I'd say the biggest thing is overwhelm.
Mm-hmm.
And energy.
Mm-hmm.
So I find I'm kind of constantly in energy saving mode for small little things. So as an example, buying 20 pairs of the same sock so I don't have to spend time matching them.
Yeah.
It sounds like such a tiny weeny thing, but my energy gets so drained just by trying to not miss trains or be on time or even come across as a normal human in a conversation or at work. Life is really quite incredibly tiring. So those mini moments when I can like snatch back a bit of energy for myself is amazing. And actually probably maybe a little bit deeper is emotional dysregulation.
Okay.
Which is a little bit vulnerable. And I'm still really learning to ask for help and go and have a cuddle when this happens to me. It's not my strongest suit. But let's say I'm getting ready to leave the house and I'm going somewhere really important. And I can't find something, which is a classic. It happens most mornings. I will almost reach kind of panic attack level.
Yeah.
Heartbeat going fast. I'm sweating. I can actually present as quite angry.
Yeah.
Not a very nice human being to be around because I get incredibly dysregulated. And actually emotional dysregulation is kind of part of the ADHD spectrum. And that can come with a lot of shame.
Mm, I can imagine.
Especially if it's him, you know, early on in the days of dating, kind of him seeing me like a headless chicken running around sweating, where's this, crying. It's not very nice. It's not how I almost want to be seen as a human being, but it's absolutely part of the experience. And I think what I'm learning still is that that's okay. It's okay if I get stressed. It's okay if I get angry. It's okay to let somebody in, to ask for help, to do my funny breathing exercise. to calm down.
Yeah.
And so I think that's a big one. What would you say as someone that lives with me?
You know, at the start, I'll probably speak into that a little bit more because it was really difficult at times. You know, there was obviously some wonderful, amazing things like the humor and the energy and you know, there's always laughter in the four walls of where we live. But actually talking about some of the things that made me as the partner of someone with ADHD feel inconsiderate, so you know, late all the time, or the room just trashed with some hyper-focused thing just after all the washing had been done and tidying and stuff like that, and you know, agreeing times that dinner would be or you saying 5 minutes and being an hour and a half, like when you don't even from you know, a neurotypical point of view, when you don't understand it and you're with someone with ADHD, it can feel very different to the reality, and that took a lot of learning on my part, you know, for each other, I guess, to cope and get through it.
Yeah, no, I can imagine. And I think that like the way you speak about that is so beautiful, in the way that like I think when we talk about neurodivergence or any kind of divergent from what we see as like the quote unquote norm, we see it as all the things that like are absent or take away or probably more negative, we're also even like highlighting like all of the, for example, there are so many incredible creatives that I've worked with who are neurodivergent in some way. So whether it's dyslexia, whether it's ADHD, et cetera, a number of different ways. There is no way I believe they could be that insanely creative and like genius in that extent, to that extent. And like, I've learned this really early on. She won't mind me talking about this, but our creative lead at Tala, she has dyslexia. I remember when we were first working together and she was kind of doing the creative and socials. And I remember we would kind of go over things and there'd be like, we implemented putting like Grammarly in place and a few of these other things, because it was like, it was for the social captions and they'd often have a number of different spelling or grammar mistakes or whatever. And it was a public facing thing. And we kind of worked together on like how to get that right, because obviously it was kind of part of her role. And I remember just essentially like having this conversation and being like, I can't ask you to be like this amazingly creative and be able to like think this far outside of the box and then be annoyed when you can't think this like in the box in this way of like getting that spelling and grammar spot on. And we've had conversations where like someone's like really rudely comment, and I get you expect to see brand communications are going to be absolutely perfect, but sometimes, you know, when there's like a spelling mistake, it might be in a socials post, and we've kind of been open about, I've said like reply at any point you want, being like, hey, like dyslexic social media manager checking in here, so sorry, you're completely right, like downloads Grammarly or whatever it might be. But I think like a long anecdote to kind of say that like fact of like there are so many amazing things about diverging from the norm in that way that we cannot expect to happen whilst also expecting you to kind of be in this like box of what that's to be seen as. And for you to be like, when you're talking about like your music or talking about like the pitch for the book or whatever it might be, like it astounds me how we expect for us to be able to have like both sides, and not to be like, the way your brain thinks will probably allow you maybe, yeah, to be like late, but also at the same time to be able to be unconstrained by time when thinking about something creative, and unconstrained by all of those things. And like, why do we expect to be able to like tick both of those things and be able to get the benefits from both of that, when realistically, like, to me, that doesn't sound like what we should be expecting.
I think you've just said something so beautiful. It's like made my spine tingle, because we don't hear that narrative very often. Mm. Very often it's like, they're late and they're messy and they're, yeah, sure, we are. Mm. But there's some other stuff that's just so wonderful. Mm. And it's kind of society, or a lot of society, values always being on time, showers every morning, getting everything right. And people that struggle with that can feel they're somehow deficient or somehow failing, mm-hmm. and miss this absolute
like superpower.
Goal, yeah, superpower, yeah, yeah. That other people might not have. And together, it's why I just feel so grateful that I have Rich, because we kind of complete the circle with the yin and yang.
Yeah.
So for instance, with the book, it was my idea to write it, and I've made the cover in Canva and written all the chapters on day one.
Right, sure.
But the person that did all the admin and researched and got it uploaded to Amazon, and that was him, because I would struggle with the more admin heavy sides.
It might have been a 2-chapter book, mightn't it?
Might have been a picture book. Might have been a kid's book, yes. So I get to see the absolute like beauty and value in both sides. It's not about kind of one being better than the other.
Yeah.
But I do truly believe that a lot of neurodivergent people have got other gifts, very often creative. And I see it. It's really interesting you mentioned that. I see it a lot in music. I work with some great artists, songwriters, producers, some diagnosed, some maybe don't realise. But I just see it in the behaviour, and there's definitely a thread. I'd love to see some more research on neurodivergence and creativity. But one thing, you know, for anybody listening, this is the thing I would have really liked to have heard, something my therapist said to me that was really quite life-changing. I was talking about struggles with keeping on top of the cleaning every day, and I want to do everything perfectly, so I want to have a Mrs. Hinch style house, and I'll do it for a week and it'll be amazing, and then it's absolute chaos.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't get a handle on it. And she said, you know, it doesn't need to be perfect. And please remember that your purpose in life isn't a perfectly tidy house. Mm. And it just, that bit of me that was constantly seeking perfection and then failing, just kind of loosened a little. It's okay if it isn't perfect.
Yeah.
Because my life purpose is over here and in books and music and something totally different.
Yeah, no, I can completely see that. And I think that like throughout life, we often get this kind of paralysis about taking action when we're looking at perfection. And like talking about perfectionism across like all people, I think a lot of the time, done is better than perfect. And I think 100% in like, I say it all the time, I have high standards and I want great work submitted, but it can't be perfect work if it's going to take 7 times the amount of time and actually we need it next week. And I think that understanding that in all walks of life is incredibly important, but especially if it like stops you taking that first step in order, you know, as you say, like seeing an unsurmountable, you know, thing of laundry or whatever it might be, rather than seeing that in a way where it's like a step-by-step one, you know, one thing at a time, it's this kind of mountain that how like would you ever climb that? What would you say are the biggest like coping strategies that you have in order to be able to, I can understand that you'd know that like done is better than perfect, but then I can imagine that doesn't always like make itself apparent in that
Should
moment.
Do step one perfectly yeah. most of the time.
When you say done is better than perfect, the thing I think about is me cleaning the bathroom.
Yeah.
So my way of cleaning a bathroom historically was to never clean it at all and kind of ignore it. And then one day this like fire inside would ignite. I'm like, right, I'm really cleaning this thing. And I'd be like on my knees with a toothbrush in the corner, like looking at YouTube videos, how to get
re-grouting.
The perfect mirror. Like literally, like, so it's this like very odd all or nothing. Mm-hmm. And it's finding that gray area in between that I try to do every day. Like if there's just one load of laundry, that's fine. I don't need to go through my entire closet and like organize it in sleeve length and like throw things. Just one load of laundry is fine. Mm-hmm. If I'm cleaning the bathroom, a quick tidy is fine. I don't need to be in the corner. However, deeper than that, I'd say, although I'm always trying to find the grey, I fail all the time.
Yeah.
Like the other night when we had a new little water feature delivered from Amazon that I wanted for the bedroom, I unpacked it at 11 p.m.
11:30.
Thank you very much. Really half the time.
Probably like nine.
A good 2 hours past our bedtime by this point.
And the grey would have been, let's deal with this tomorrow and that's okay. It doesn't all need to be set up now. The grey didn't win that day, the all or nothing one. So not only were we unpacking it, sorry, it was he unpacking it and setting it up. I then decided it didn't look right unless I had could feng shui all of the bedside tables and move all the books around. And it was another hour of kind of...
Hour and a half.
No, thank you very much. I have been timekeeping. So, I have the timesheet.
I love how you know that. So like finding the grey, amazing, go for it. But deeper than that, it's just like sometimes okay to be who you are and to not feel incredible shame to be different.
Because also thinking about like the superpower angle again, sure, that's probably not what you wanted at 11:30.
The room does look great though.
Well, but I also think like who else would be able to have that energy to suddenly get so excited by something to be able to re-feng shui a whole room?
Not me.
Which, well, exactly not you, which crucially is the point there. There probably was maybe some sleep to be had. But I also think that like in that moment, like, do you know how it like... exciting that is, the fact that you would get so excited about this delivery that you want to be able to like make everything look great. Like, I understand that, yeah, sure, it's not the most practical thing. And like, there are going to be times where it's like, maybe like not now, but also like to be able to just be like, do you know what? We don't have enough of that excitement in our lives. Like we don't have enough of those like, oh my God, this is going to transform the whole thing. I, for example, had a, like was up at 3 last night and I had this idea and I actually came in and pitched it to the whole team this morning. It's not even about work. It's literally my personal life. But I got so excited about this idea that I bullet pointed all the questions we needed to ask to all the people, then did a summary of the entire thing of work and mood boarded it as well at like 3. And my boyfriend was driving me in this morning and I was like, I'm going to pitch it to you tomorrow. And he was like, when did this start? I'm like, 3, you were fast asleep, you're like spooning the dog, and I'm here like mood boarding on Instagram. And like, I understand, sure, inconvenient for all, like including yourself, like that's probably not what you probably were overexhausted the next day and all of this, but like talk about like being able to actually get like this like proper excitement and kind of like real boost of like energy to be able to make something amazing happen. A lot of people would look at that in the opposite and have like no excitement to do with it or whatever. Like, at least you really got your joy out of that Amazon
order.
I agree.
And I, you know, I can jokingly moan about it, but it's fun. Yeah. It's funny. And I'll know that there are some things just by looking at her face that to put a boundary around and say, no, we can't do that. This just wasn't one of those.
Did not have that.
And also, like, I think that neurodivergence or not, there are always going to be that, like, as in, I think sometimes when we're able to label something, especially in a relationship, and especially when it's like the similar issues that come up, it's able to really be kind of like put in this specific ADHD box. But it's also like there are always going to be frustrations with partners as well, and being like, oh my god, why are you doing this again? Like, whether it is because of that or whether it's because of an annoying thing they do, like, there's always going to be kind of that side, and that normalizing also being able to be annoyed at it and seeing that it can be a great thing, but being like, it's a great thing, but like currently I would like to be asleep, and actually being able to have that, like I love the open line of communication in that way. I think it's kind of the only way that, I mean, I think in relationships in general, that's kind of one of the most important things. When you're like trying to find that gray area and you're like in the task, is there anything that you're able to do that kind of like brings you back to that when you see yourself going for that like real all?
I mean, it depends what it is. If it's like a water feature and it's got a spinning resin orb, sure. And it like, I can't. Like, I'm sorry, I just have to go for it. If it's buying 20 pairs of socks, I have to go for it. The areas where I've really learned to slow down is when there's a big cost involved or a lot of time.
Yeah.
And funnily enough, that is often in business. So just you talking about it being 3 a.m. and you're... I just to hear that so much. Like,
so
that is
hard.
Me to a T, whether it's writing a song or some random business idea. It happens at the weirdest of times. Sometimes those things can be genius. I can't wait to see what goes and happens in the personal life.
I want to know as well. I want to see the mood board.
But for so much of my life, I was really dragged by those impulses. So I've just like started so many businesses. Maybe in the years as well before I got sober and before I'd had therapy. So actually mentally I wasn't healthy enough to see it through. But I'd be dragged always. And like the minute an idea would drop in my head, it drops fully formed. So I'm on Insta, I'm getting the handles, I'm registering the trademark, I'm designing the logo. And it was 5 minutes ago I had the idea. And it's actually quite a funny story, if you don't mind me telling the resin story. Because this experience with Rich has really helped me learn to not jump in and go and find a new life purpose every time I have a new business idea.
Yeah.
It was quite early on in our dating, and I had seen, I don't know if you've seen them, they're like resin tables. It's like a wooden table with like a resin river through the middle.
Oh, yes, I have.
Oh, they're just amazing. So I saw that, became obsessed with the idea that I wanted to learn how to make resin. We were very early on, so he had no idea that this was quite a regular occurrence, like random business ideas.
Right,
I thought we were on the cusp of being millionaires.
I thought
this is genius. Oh my god, what's happened? This is a one in a lifetime thing, not a one in a month thing.
So I tell him, like, babe, we have to start a resin company. We get the name. What was it?
Resonate.
It was Resonate, but then that was taken. So then it was Family.
Oh, House of Resin.
House of Resin.
Yeah.
So I'm on 123 Reg, I'm buying the domain. Yeah.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Looking at how to do it, I'm watching the YouTube videos, we buy all the gear, we start making resin. It is like holding that first like glittery ashtray in your hand is unreal. He's looking into how to make the tables.
Start an Etsy shop.
We start an Etsy shop, and then it kind of starts to wane for me. Right. And I'm like, I am technically a songwriter. I need to go back
actually
to the studio. I don't know how to do this.
It's quite long. Of the business of like the output.
The output. It's quite hard. Is this really the passion? So my passion wanes. And this has happened to me so many times. I buy all the equipment, the 123 reg domain. I probably own 20. And then it wanes. And this was your first experience. And actually, the fact that we'd spent like 400 quid on like all the resin gear and the face mask. We then had a convo about the next time when the next idea came to me, which was the gender neutral clothing line, which was, it's a wonderful idea. Let's brainstorm it, plan it, do the logo, but let's not start it.
Yeah.
And weirdly enough, it's so strange, but I got as much happiness from the planning as I did from actually doing it, maybe even more. So that's where I've really learned to find the grey. Because actually, feng shuiing your room at 11:30, it's not that harmful. Spending loads of money, spending loads of time, perhaps our most valuable asset, on another business venture when actually we're wanting to do ADHD Love and write the next book, and I'm going on tour in May. It's about knowing when the right time to strike is with those 3 a.m. ideas.
Yeah, no, I can completely understand that. And I think that like the dopamine hit that you get often from pursuing something brand new rather than working through the tough parts of something existing. So like, say if you had like the, don't worry, I relate. I have a whole spreadsheet of domain names.
Do you?
Yes, I do. And I think anyone in my team can probably, you know, probably thinks they're talking to me right now. But I think like in terms of the actual like, understanding what you're getting out of something, because I think like sometimes I just like need the dopamine hit of doing that, but I completely agree you can get it from doing far less. And I think that what's particularly important is as an adult, when you actually do have the, sometimes you don't even have the kind of like resources to be able to do it, but like if you have the kind of freedom that no one's going to sit there and tell you like, no, actually you need to go to school, you actually genuinely could spend the next week working on this thing, understanding what you're needing from it and what the really exciting part of it is. Sometimes getting the dopamine hit anyway, but always creating a buffer. So like if there's like this kind of, you know, if it's a good idea, it will still be a good idea in a week's time.
Protecting yourself. I think you referred to it as like not playing against yourself. Yeah. If it's taken away from your job and your songwriting and the stuff that we need to do, then maybe it's not worth pursuing.
And that, is it a good idea in a week? It's just so wonderful. It's just like sense checking. Do we need to go all in now? Are we staying up all night to get this launched tomorrow?
Yeah.
Or is it a little bit of patience and let's think about it? And again, that's the beauty I find of teamwork, because I'm coming at him all the time with random crazy ideas, some of which probably are genius, most of which are probably rubbish and never going to happen. But I have someone who can logically just sense check where would the time come from.
And also who you trust has your best interests at heart, because I think there's a difference between shutting down continuous ideas because for someone who's maybe doesn't think the same, that's going to get to a point where you're like, stop. Enough of the new ideas, but actually being able to be like, still be able to see that there's like, some of them are going to be great and some of them are going to be not so great. Just the fact that there are so many does not negate the fact that some of them are going to be great.
Absolutely. But I also think it's not always about shutting them down. It's quite often, and we'll talk about it when she comes up, she just wants me to get in the fantasy with her to experience that date. So she still gets all of the dopamine, and then us going, actually, let's not remortgage to start with.
You will often say, it will often start with, this is not the right time, there's no time. And I'll kind of look a bit sad, and he'll go, but do you want me just to play along with it, get in the fantasy? Yes. And he'll come in, we'll be brainstorming the name and where the office is going to be. And 9 times out of 10, the next day, I've forgotten it and it's over. But then that one time, well, that was when we let's do the TikTok account, and that's why we're here.
Yeah, sure.
And writing a book, and that's why all these things are happening. So, you know, what you said, the difference between someone that you trust, it's actually allowing that creativity to just be wild and free, and sometimes catching that one idea that could actually change your life and maybe other people's, as you know, with your life and your businesses.
Yeah, no, I mean, I can completely understand that. I completely see, you know, where the difference between that is. And I think a lot of the time, like the whole point of talking about something as a neurodivergence is understanding that it's divergent from the norm. So like, there's always going to be like a difference in the way things are thought about. And that can, I can see how in some situations there would just be like a blanket, like just stop doing this. Yeah. Whereas actually it's not about stopping doing that. It's about like harnessing the good parts and being able to dull the effects of the bad parts. And I think rather than kind of just being like, never have an idea again and let's not spend half a day doing this again, like that could, you can spend a half day doing whatever you want to do, but there are going to be some times where it's like, actually, do you know what you really need to do right now is you need to meet that other deadline, and then on Saturday we can talk about the 1-2-3 bridge. I want to talk about work a little bit and kind of productivity in general. I know that's one of the biggest obstacles when it comes to ADHD. First of all, before your diagnosis, what were the biggest issues, if any, you had in terms of productivity?
Biggest issues were actually finding a job to stick with.
Okay.
Because I didn't understand, like what we've just spoken about, this sometimes you have an idea and you don't follow it. I was just following every impulse. So I have, when I left uni, I trained to be an accountant, and then I left that, and then I went and worked for a beauty magazine. Then I was an investment banker for a couple of years. Then I went into songwriting, and then I went into music management. I just tried all these different things, and I'd get bored quite quickly and then want to go and change. So that's the first thing, which is understanding that I might get bored at some point, but there's ways to really reinvigorate jobs and make them exciting, a change of environment or a change of collaborator, because you really do need to find that sticking power. Since being diagnosed, I think it's just meant I get to really be okay with the fact I find things hard. I think a really great example is us writing the book, because it's 35,000 words, which was a lot of hours sat at a laptop. So I couldn't just sit there every day and write for the same amount of time. I wouldn't access the magic, because the magic is a little bit wonky. Like, I have to protect it and have to call it into being. So the first thing we did, this is going to sound so crazy, was I would pretend that I was giving a TED talk.
And like, I'd be typing.
And he would type. And I mean, like, I would have a ring light on myself. And
oh my
I'd
God,
stand
I love
up
this.
And I'd say, welcome to my TED talk on ADHD. Because pretending like I was on a stage allowed me to access the magic. And I could talk about it and add personality. And then you were there just like rapidly typing, trying to get it all down. And we were able to get the sort of skeleton of most of the chapters done in that way. So is there a sort of creative way that can really make you a bit more excited to do the thing you're doing? And then secondly, when we got onto the sort of editing, when I was really having to go into it, it was environmental stuff, things that would really help my brain to focus. So I would always have Spotify focus music on. So my Spotify Wrapped was like Zen 4 hour, 4 hertz.
Like, yes. Music. Have you used brown noise?
No,
I've seen it go viral. So
Have you seen it?
You were listening to something.
I saw it on TikTok.
You are in for some real excitement with brown noise.
Tell me about brown noise.
So, well, I don't know the what effect it's meant to have on everyone, but essentially a teacher actually suggesting, why don't you listen to music while doing stuff at the same time? And I was like, oh, well, I get distracted by that. But basically they'd explained it by like, if you say like have to tick 5 boxes to be able to concentrate, some people's brains are able to do 5 boxes at once through like reading something, but some people who get more distracted more easily are able to do 2 boxes at once, and you need the rest, those other 3, to be filled by something else. Otherwise they're going to be filled by like listening to all the, like thinking about all these other things. Like, I realize when I'm like even doing a podcast, I'm literally, not to be rude, but I'm literally thinking about like what I'm gonna have for dinner and like all of these, like so much so that I'll then like be back in the room and be like, Hello. Zone out. Like shepherd's pie. Like as in like it's just, you know, ooh, like that's the way it,
lovely.
That's the way it kind of like works for me. Whereas like understanding that like every time I need to do deep work, I have to have something that fills in those other three boxes. Wow. For me was like quite an important recognition. This is really niche, but there is a difference between the way you'll listen to music versus the way that other people will listen to music. If you have a like understanding of like musical analysis, so you'll be able to listen to it in a like slightly different way. So it's a difference between like hearing and listening. Mm. And so you might also get distracted by listening to specific music where you get essentially like too taken by that like yes. analytical yeah, side of the yeah. music. So like the brown noise, which is literally just like, I would sing it if I could. It's like, yeah, exactly that. And it literally, you will, I mean, personally, it had an insane effect okay. on me. There's a Spotify playlist on it.
Okay, you can brown noise it, but yeah. coming little, to my Spotify.
Yeah,
rap.
Have a little listen. But to me, okay. that made like a huge difference. Sorry, that was no, an interruption.
I love that. And I'm gonna go and check it out and totally agree. Anything with lyrics, I'm just in that world or I'm thinking about that. But what you said about the five things, I've never heard that, but actually that was what I was doing intuitively because it was a focus playlist and it was, which is obviously kind of your hearing, it was low lighting or yeah. candlelight or like yeah. LED blue lights, couldn't have bright lights on. So that was obviously the eyes. And then there was also having aromatherapy going
okay.
or a candle for the smell. So I was trying to fill in those other five senses,
yeah.
and then I could get that laser focus on word.
So two things I want to say. I think first of all, I think part of that as well, creating cues for yourself that put yourself in an environment. So like in the same way as we have like sleep hygiene, where you might put on the same playlist, spray some lavender spray, like whatever it might be to put you in that like sleep zone, having like work hygiene around like you work in a specific place, you work it. And for some people, they'll need to work in a different place every time. Personally, not the case. I like to give myself cues. So it might be the same playlist. It might be the same positioning. It might be the same routine before I get into it, whatever it might be. Like giving yourself these cues so your brain kind of subconsciously knows what you're about to do, I think is also, like, personally, I found very important. The second thing I wanted to say is the 5-point thing and the fact that I had that explained to me at school as someone who went to private school and was in private education is also probably a big point of like, the large majority of people obviously were not privately educated.
Yeah.
Like the, you know, the stats are ridiculous in the UK and the discrepancy is ridiculous. But even the fact that a teacher could explain that to me to be like, this might be why you're not concentrating, rather than being like, literally get out of my class. You are yeah. causing a ruckus and you're stupid. Actually able to like, it's really upsetting to think of like the amount of people who will have been through the education system. And like, I ended up going to, you know, a fantastic uni and understanding that my, like I was, you know, learned a bit differently and like all of these different things. Whereas actually the large majority of people who had a, like, you know, a different way of working would have been seen in that like completely different way and just being like, oh, sounds like classroom's not right for you. Whereas yeah. I, you know,
definitely
was great at writing essays, but wasn't great at sitting still.
I think we learned recently from a psychologist that for neurodivergent people, and I think it was specifically ADHD, they receive something like 50,000 pieces of criticizing feedback more than a neurotypical person by the time they're early teens.
Yeah.
Probably for reason.
Yeah. For that reason, again, I think it's a beautiful thing to talk about. And hopefully conversations like this and just the fact that more people are talking about it, it's going to kind of feed through into schools. But certainly my experience at school, which was a comprehensive school, yours was as well, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I was seen as disruptive and naughty and often kind of labelled very bright because I could memorise the test like the night before and then and then go and do well, but actually it wasn't real work. And that way, when somebody sees you and labels you a troublemaker or disruptive, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So when I went to uni, I went as, yeah, I'm not going to lessons, I'm going out drinking. I had no self-esteem in terms of that I could achieve. And that actually led to quite rock bottom self-esteem, which is really sad because then all those 3 a.m. creative ideas just went to a sort of wasteland because you don't understand that you can succeed whilst being different.
Mm.
And my case shows like getting help in my mid-30s. And since sobriety therapy and then diagnosis, my life has turned on its head. Getting out of debt, finding a beautiful relationship, and then at work, writing hit records and having a best-selling book. Things that felt so far away for so many years because I just believed I was a troublemaker, a loser, and all those things.
Yeah, I think that's incredibly important to talk about. And I'd like to talk about within that the kind of financial aspect in terms of the implications that you found ADHD has had on your kind of finances or the way you budget, or, you know, it's a very, I think budgeting is actually quite a weirdly quite controversial topic anyway. There's like a lot of people who think that budgeting is like dieting, and therefore if you restrict it, you're going to want to like clonor it up the rest of the time, or like you know, if you're like when you get to payday and you're kind of completely splurging, or there's going to be some people who like swear by it, all of these different things. But I can understand that that would be completely different when it comes to ADHD as well.
I think it's a wonderful thing to talk about, and my story's how you mentioned earlier, there's everyone, you know, has different parts of this spectrum. Finances was one of the areas I struggled with most. And it's something that we are a bit embarrassed to talk about.
100%,
we don't talk about money, whether you're earning money or whether you're in debt. And especially if you're in debt, it can be so bad for mental health and so stressful, so much shame attached to it. And I think for neurodivergent people especially. So what that meant for me was, part of ADHD, there's an executive function problem, which is very simply finding admin quite difficult. Very much oversimplifying there, but for this story, that's what I'll say. So opening letters from a credit card company, for example, would be something I found really difficult. Pair that with another symptom of ADHD, impulsivity. So shopping, overspending money I didn't have, going to the local bar, buying shots for everybody, putting it on a credit card. I ran up an incredible amount of debt on different credit cards. I wasn't opening the letters. I was ignoring everything. And I was just kind of drinking every day to push that stress away. And obviously it catches up with you. You cannot run from that kind of thing forever. And I remember one night, I was living in London in a basement flat in Marylebone, and these people turned up at my door. I also didn't answer my door because that's just not something I like doing. It gives me a lot of anxiety. So people banging down my door, and it ended up being kind of workmen there to take out my access to electricity and put in a pay-as-you-go meter because I hadn't paid my bill. So I'd lost access. And that then meant I had to go to the shop to top it up, something I found really difficult to do. So I was often sat at home, like just in the dark, without Wi-Fi, just like, you know, very, very sad and very, very low, and wondering, why can't I just go to the shop to put £10 on this? And I couldn't do it. Thankfully now that doesn't happen because I've had a lot of support, and there's kind of so much hope in that story. Like for anyone that is in that place really struggling, it's never as bad as you seem when you open that first letter. It just isn't. And there's often an email address, and you can email someone and make a payment plan, even if you can't afford the whole thing. A big part of my recovery was getting out of debt and really learning to budget and also really learning to, for example, I don't have credit cards now because
they're in my wallet.
Oh, sorry, they're in your wallet. Because even when I'd worked myself out of 40 grand's worth of debt and done it through really, really hard work in music and also having your wonderful help, I have a bank manager, fiance.
A bank.
So come on,
No, I'm actually a bank.
He is a bank. So like you were a lifesaver to me. But even when I'd come out through all of that, and I've had these darkest days, I still went and ran up my credit card.
Yeah, right.
And it's like, oh, it doesn't make any sense. What are you doing? Haven't you learned this lesson? No, I haven't, because that impulsivity, that dopamine need can sometimes overpower logic and learning. So my choice was, I'm just not going to have credit cards. And that's been really, really helpful. And I have my little budget. I have my kind of monthly salary. And I've actually found joy now in having money left over.
Yeah.
And like not being in the overdraft.
And that dopamine hit, and said, like, if you're going to need a dopamine hit, like understanding where you can, like, you can have this one, but not that one. These are two different.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What would you say? Because you are the bank.
Well, I think
how it affects money.
You know, it was one of the first things that you mentioned, because you obviously carried a huge amount of shame with it. And I remember her saying to me, like, I've got to be honest with you, it's a mess. I'm in debt. If we want to buy a house together, I'm not sure we're going to be able to.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, of course, what felt huge for Rox didn't so much for me, working as a bank for 20 years. That's going to stick now, isn't it?
The bank.
It's definitely, yes. That's going to be a thing. So we just worked through it step by step. I would say, you know, Rox is much better with managing our finances and made some, you know, really good decisions about not having credit cards. I still think there's probably one area that probably does need an eye keeping on, like, because
but maybe always, like,
she's fine,
maybe always will, like, in a kind of, like, there are, coming back to that point where it's like there are always going to be things that are going to be like you might just never be good at, and you can create cues and barriers and like hurdles that you need to jump over to be able to make, like, the 48 hour buffer or like the week buffer or like the not having credit cards. Like, you can mother yourself in a way that it kind of, like, the chances of things going wrong are much lower, but that still doesn't mean that it's going to suddenly be your best aptitude.
Certainly with ADHD, because quite often, obviously not all, but money can have access to dopamine, right?
Right.
Like, you can buy nice things and have received the packages and stuff. That's all kind of what it stems from. So yeah.
It is. But I love that. Just want to hammer home that point a bit more as well. That sense of you might always be like that and it's okay.
As long as you're able to, as
long as you're safe. So for me, not opening letters from energy bills, that's not okay. That can cause damage to your mental health and then your credit rating and all that kind of stuff. But if it's little things like, you know, buying 20 pairs of socks, or sometimes if we go and stay in a hotel, I do want the one that looks a bit more kind of dopamine inducing. Like, it's okay. It's okay to be like that, and just putting those kind of protective barriers in. And actually, that's one thing I do want to say about the credit rating. There is joy in watching that improve.
Because
when I met him, mine was the lowest. I think that's very poor.
Mm-hmm.
And again, a massive amount of shame. I've always been terrible. I'll never be able to get a mortgage. That's just me. And through really sensible and shame-free conversations, he kind of spoke me through, you know, register to vote at this address, have your name on a utility bill, have them come out by direct debit so you never forget. These little markers that were actually really easy to do. And over 2 years, I went from very poor to excellent.
Yeah.
And the feeling of pride that I have is like looking at my credit rating. There's dopamine there. So
kind of encouraging the good dopamine.
Chasing the good dopamine.
I love that phrase, the good dopamine.
We love
it. Because it's every, but I think it is really true. Like, as in, I hate the idea that it's kind of like, oh, well, you have a neurodivergence and therefore you can't chase the dopamine. Like, that's such like a horrible sentence. Like, as in, like, it's just being like, oh, well, you're never going to be able to have that like impulsive, amazing hit of like whatever it might be, which, you know, everyone has to an extent, but I can imagine with an addictive personality or with like ADHD or like a number of these different things, it's always, there's going to be like even further kind of need for that. But it's actually being like, it's not saying like you can never have a dopamine hit. It's being like, you know, that dopamine hit of like writing out the whole business plan and not doing it, or like, you know, whatever it might be. Like, for example, I remember seeing this thing where it's about someone who, in terms of like that impulsive kind of shopping aspect, and would just be like, sometimes it then happens and like, you know that it's going to, like, you have the dopamine of like unwrapping it, and then it's like, and 2 days later I will decide which I am keeping, because that dopamine has kind of like subsided. And it's like allowing yourself to kind of have these buffers, and obviously different things will help for everyone, but then being like, and these go back and I got the dopamine. Like, I was there and I was doing the unwrapping.
Yeah,
it's just sending them back though.
Exactly. That sounds like the admin
sometimes. Filling a cart, doing all the research with these 10 items of clothing, and then not buying it. It's amazing. You can still like get that high.
Yeah.
It's a funny thing.
No, I can completely understand that. And
for anyone who might be in the position that you were in, where they've avoided perhaps opening letters and are in a bit of debt or kind of getting into that position, what advice would you give to someone at that time?
To ask for help from a safe and trusted person, whether that's a friend, a partner, hopefully family member, and to say without shame, I've got myself in a real mess. I can't face it. Could you just sit with me while I open this? And it's such a small thing. But for me, I was burying my head in the sand and it was getting worse and worse and worse and worse. And it was actually quite a dangerous position to be in for mental health. So to ask for help, because somebody that loves you will sit next to you, and it takes the weight off to have someone going, that's okay. Okay, so that's 2,000. I know that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
And to just encourage you to send that first email and to make a plan.
Also, just in case there's no access to something like that, there are charities like Step Change and stuff like that. If it's too bad, they'll kind of negotiate all your creditors for you and stuff like that
to take a
lot of that anxiety away.
Yeah, that's really, really helpful, because I can imagine that, I mean, it is so stigmatized. And like, I think that actually just even knowing that there are places out there that are designed to like help that, it really, I can imagine it is very much like the first step that's probably going to be the
hardest.
Yeah. And then kind of creating those barriers that allow you to avoid getting to that position, as hard as that is, of course. I'd like to talk a bit about dating with ADHD and relationships with ADHD and kind of the effect you found of that kind of before and after your diagnosis and kind of the experiences that you had.
This is a juicy one.
So earlier you said something which was about business and you know, we always want to chase the new idea. Same thing applies to love and to relationships. And obviously, every human being goes through the honeymoon phase. And in the book, I call it ADHD people have like a treacle sun. Honeymoon, treacle sun, because it's sweeter and it's hotter and it's so much more intense. It's just the way, it's the dopamine receptors in the brain. It just lands a little heavier. So for me, I was constantly chasing the new person. I have had 10 relationships last about a year. I don't want to say it's all ADHD related. I also had some issues with intimacy from some things went through in childhood that I've had therapy for. But ADHD definitely played a role, which was massively intense. Commit my life. Let's move in early. We're going to make it. 6 months. Oh, wait, that I've crashed down. Oh, my God, I'm not sure. Meet somebody else. That dopamine high is ignited again, off I go. Caused a lot of carnage. I'm ashamed to say that I cheated on people. I hurt a lot of people. And yeah, it was pretty brutal. A lot of behavior that I'm not proud of. As part of the recovery journey, getting sober from alcohol, which was 2018, I also put myself on the bench. I'm not dating. I'm going to just not do any of that. Almost getting sober from love in a way. And it was that time when I, even though I didn't have the ADHD language, I could really see this pattern, this roller coaster up, down. I didn't want that to be the rest of my life. I really wanted to find a life partner, and then met you. And when we met, it was, and then had the ADHD language to describe, we were so honest with each other. I told the truth about how my brain works, and I hope it's okay for me to kind of tell the story.
I don't know what you're going to say, but it's fine anyway.
So I knew this relationship was different, because I had all this like armor, this sobriety, this therapy, this diagnosis. But that doesn't mean I'm not human and I'm not who I am. So after about a year, I had a wonky wobble where I felt this high decreasing. And I'm like, oh my God, not again. I've done everything right to maintain love. What's happening? And I was so scared that I was losing the most wonderful thing in my life and I didn't know what to do. But rather than do what I'd done before, which is cut and run, and I think that's where the therapy can really help you to make a more sensible decision. I actually chose to speak to Rich.
Mm-hmm.
Really incredibly hard convo, and he can share what that was like for him in a minute. But I said, I'm really scared because this massive high is gone. My feelings are changing. I love you, mm-hmm. but I do not know
yeah.
what to do right mm. now. And I remember him, we were in an Indian restaurant, and I was like this little ball of shame admitting yeah. this, you know, my feelings are changing, what do I do? And he just reached across and held my hand and went, that sounds so scary down there. I hope you're okay. And I just started crying because how is this person accepting that I'm saying I'm scared of my feelings changing? Mm. And actually that was the beginning of this other level of love, this mm. like really vulnerable, you know, the beginning falling in love. Great. We can all mm. do that.
Mm.
Can you dig down and show someone that the real root cause of your vulnerabilities? And we did. Obviously, you can speak.
Well, I'm still here a year. We lasted more than a year. So I'm obviously number 11 at nearly 4 years.
Lucky number 11.
That is what they say. The well-known saying.
The well-known saying, lucky number 11. I think, yeah, it would, a couple of things. One, just very briefly, my backstory. I've got two long-term relationships or exes, two ex-wives actually, both married, both 7 years.
Lucky so, number three. That is the same.
So lucky number three is actually a saying, I think. And of course, it was really hard to hear when, you know, the brutal honesty of Rox saying that feelings have changed and she don't know what. I think she went into a bit of a kind of dissociation, was like, I don't even know what love is and stuff like that. It was quite challenging. However, just kind of chose to, I had a choice, right? I could either just, it could be looking for the lucky number four in or stick with it. And we just kind of knew, you know, we both sober from alcohol, like there's just something was different. So chose to lean in. And I suppose that is, you know, you say, you refer to it as like a deeper thing of love. That's where the stuff that matters is shared, like the real vulnerability, yeah. like I struggle to make a bed or I struggle with it. Like some of the real vulnerabilities and getting to know each other, and we just work through it. And it's a bit of a running joke now. I actually said the other day, like we're not life partners, we're death partners. Like I'm lucky number 11. She's the third. You know,
death parties because you're going to hopefully die together. That sounds so morbid.
No, I. But do you know I like what I mean? It. It's giving scary vibes.
It's giving
but I
scary
like it.
Vibes. It's death vibes. I'm death so here partners, for that. Yeah.
No, but I also think that like understand like again one of those points where it's like in relationships like and I this is where I think therapy is so important. But even just an understanding of like where your downfalls are and understanding like where your triggers are and like all of these things, like whether you have abandonment issues and therefore you're going to self-sabotage when you feel like someone's pulling away or like whatever it might be. And I think that like understanding those things and being able to be vocal about those things is like it's terrifying. Like it's so terrifying. But even like to obviously amazing things happened there. Like you were able to sit down and be like, this is how I feel at the risk of you being like, well, that sounds shit, bye. But also you were able to say that's like, let's see how it works out or whatever it might be. And I just think that like I don't personally think that relationships can ever work without us knowing our biggest downfalls. Like I think you have to be so self-aware. If we're talking about like life partners and we're talking about like, that's talking about like, 50 years, like if not more of like, you know, that's a lot. Like you really, you can't fake that. Like you can be unhappy in it, but you can't fake that. But actually being able to really get to grips with like, where are your biggest downfalls? What do you like? I know mine, for example, like I know that I'll kind of like, when I feel like something's slightly wrong, I'll just switch off entirely. And I'll just be like, I'm just completely like numb, all of, you know, whatever it might be. And actually understanding those so that you can be like, by the way, explaining to you now that it's not that I don't care. This is currently how I feel and it's a defense mechanism, but like I work through it. I know it's not my actual feelings. Whatever it might be, I think is like, you cannot have love and like relationships and be able to work through things without that. I also think that we all have a slight, and this is not to take down the importance of like the ADHD aspect of it, but I also think we all have this, you know, the kind of reason why people go for emotionally avoidant people and that kind of whole idea of like
butterflies and all of these things where it's actually just hits of dopamine where you aren't getting that attention the rest of the time. Yeah. Like we all have this slight it's in our nature to be drawn to things that kind of pull away or give us little hits of something. It's very boring to have a constant, stable love. Yeah. Like, of course it's going to be boring when you look at that. It's why toxic relationships often last so long and are so difficult to get out of, because it feels like there's more dopamine than like someone running to get the newspaper in the morning. Like that's not exciting. And actually understand, like I've had some conversations with my friends recently of being like, I thought I loved that person so much and actually they were just giving me attention half the time. So I felt that much more love when they did. Whereas actually that other person was stable and committed and vulnerable and all of these things, which sounds pretty boring. Like it's really important. Yeah. And it's the only thing I personally think that's going to like create like long lasting love and relationships. But actually it is also in its essence going to be quite boring some of the time. And maybe boring is what we want to aim
boring
for. Maybe boring is happiness and stability.
Like boring is, and it gets such a bad rap. And as someone that was an absolute wild child in my 20s, chasing all the hedonism, the girls, the guys, the drink, the drugs, living the craziest life, I was miserable because I was constantly running after those desires and I never got to make a choice. And actually boring, bed at 9, eating breakfast together in the morning, knowing if they need a bath because they've had a bad day, it's where the magic is. And I've noticed I get these moments of joy. Never used to get them before, joy, and it will be a really random thing. We might be in Tesco and we have our stepchild there and they've wandered off to do something and I'll get this rush of just happiness and it'll bring tears to my eyes. It doesn't happen all the time. It's like every few weeks, but you have to have this boring, wonderful, loving stability to then access this absolute joy, and it's so worth it.
Yeah.
But it's not glamorized as much as the toxic love in society. So maybe we'll start here.
I think as well, you started by saying how important therapy is, and obviously not everybody has access to it, but the stuff that we're talking about is so useful to have that language, because I can probably safely say that without us both being in therapy, we just wouldn't have been together, because we wouldn't have had the tools and the skills to kind of get through it. And I think understanding each other, but more importantly, ourselves a huge amount more, and what stuff in the past is affecting this, and abandonment issues and rejection and all of that's it's amazing when you go through that, but it's also quite a privilege to be able to, I suppose, in a lot of occasions.
Yeah. Oh, well, I think that's an amazing place to end. We were actually originally going to do an Instagram Q&A, but we've actually had such a lovely conversation. And I think actually it's been such a great experience to be able to kind of hear from your perspective, but also just like to see how beautiful your relationship is together, I think is just, I mean, it's so special and it's amazing to watch. And thank you for coming and talking to me, because I think this will help a huge amount of people. So
thank you so much
for having us. It's been really, really wonderful. Really appreciate it.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.